And I am from Brazil, but working in Chicago for the last 9 years, where Eric also was a student. So still is, right, Eric? What else? Well, that's enough. Unless you have questions about that. I always say, please interrupt me at any time, and let's have some more discussion. I feel sort of guilty because I'm always in the midst of a bind. I know that speaking too much does not help. On the other hand, I feel guilty when I don't do it. speak on my behalf. So relieve me of my guilt and do participate. That would be a gesture of great compassion on your part. There was a. I just want to finish the part of the church and society that I was describing last time to get into the discussion about church and tradition. I don't know if that became clear to you, but what I'm trying to do is to say, in the discussion about church and society, what I was trying to say is how does the church emerge in any spatial reality? When I'm going to be discussing the church and tradition, is what is the church as it emerges and changes during time? I forgot to mention last time to you a famous discussion. There is some people that called it the most significant philosophical discussion of the 20th century, and at least in the Western world, was a discussion between two German philosophers. One was a Jewish, and another one not. But their names were the Jewish philosopher was Walter Benjamin. And the other one, they were very good friends, and they collaborated together in an institute in Frankfurt. The other was Max Horkheimer, and both of them were involved with what's called the Frankfurt School. And it was Benjamin that developed the theory of the weak messianic forces in history. Although he considered himself a Marxist and a historical materialist, he came out with this conviction that. And this is connected with my remarks about the resurrection last time. He came out with this conviction that if history was not open, if the victims of the past could not be vindicated, if their suffering could not be vindicated, if justice could not be done to those whose life ended as victims of others, then history would not make any sense at all. And he wrote that for an article to a journal that Max Horkheimer was publishing. And Max Horkheimer retorts to him and says, this is the sort of thing that is pure theology, says there is no possibility of recovering the past suffering that has gone in the world. And then Benjamin turns back to him. That was during the Nazi period. And Benjamin ended up, he tried to flee Germany as a Jew, and ended up being not caught, but being in a situation that he couldn't cross the frontier between France and Spain. He wanted to flee to Spain, and ended up committing suicide in the end of the 30s or beginning of the 40s already. And Benjamin reports to Horkheimer when Horkheimer says there is no way, victims of the past are victims, and there is nothing that we can do about that. And this thought of yours, says Horkheimer, is pure theology. And Benjamin retorts to him and says there is no way in which we can responsibly do any philosophical or historical research without having to resort to theology. And he says that history must be open. And if it is not open, it is senseless. And I think this is an important notion in connection with the understanding of the church, because the church is in the midst of this reality as a sort of a token of another reality that we cannot yet touch, like that cipher that I was speaking about last time. We don't have access to it, but the church is a sort of a cipher in the midst of our reality that says it's pointing to something that people have invested their lives on. And people have sacrificed themselves for. So I think this is an important notion that we need to keep up with to retain. last time I used the notion of metabolism in order to describe whatever the church is, whatever brings about the emergence of the church, this encounter of different powers and sources in history that bring about. And the example that I was given was the one of the formation of the base Christian communities, in which the church emerges, the communities emerge out of this need of a people that were organizing themselves politically, and then they gain a language in order to express their most cherished ideals and revolt as well. But I would like to move ahead and try to offer some other implications of this understanding of the church, in which there is a back and forth movement between when this encounter, this metabolic encounter between different entities takes place. And there is a mutual, in any metabolism, there is an exchange of matter, right? The word metabolism is precisely that. It's being thrown over the limit, metabole. Bole means being thrown, meta, beyond one's own realm. And that is a movement that, as I have pointed out last time, goes in both directions. The church is at the same time asked to disinstall itself, to move beyond its own confines, its own realm, its own familiar territory, into another territory, and be a sort of a guest into this other territory. And I think this is what the idea of mission in the early church was about. I was talking to Mike after last session, and Mike was saying, how do you say, Mike, we got it all the other way around, right?
Backwards,
yeah. We think that mission is bringing people over to our space, when Jesus sends, the disciples sends it to the other city, to the other town, so that they can become guests there in the other place. And only after we experience what it means to become a guest in somebody else's space, we are also able to understand what this hospitality, the welcoming of the other, might really mean. Otherwise, we don't have a clue of what this is about. Let me use an example that I think is very fascinating, and there are some language problems in English to convey it, and I would like to call your attention to this. Let's get some Bibles here. We have some there. Let's open it in Luke chapter 19. Okay. And could I ask someone to read the verses 1 through 10 of Luke 19?
He entered Jericho and was passing through it. A man was there named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. He was trying to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not, because he was short in stature. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore tree to see him, because he was going to pass that way. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today." So he hurried down and was happy to welcome him. All who saw it began to grumble and say, "He has gone to be the guest of one who is a sinner." Zacchaeus stood there and said to the Lord, "Look, half of my possessions, Lord, I will give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay back four times as much." Then Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because he too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek out and to save the lost."
Mm-hmm. Thank you. The story is very well, I believe, is very well known, right? It's so plastic in it, so almost the image is almost come to our mind of this short man that wants to see Jesus and is a very rich tax collector, and you know that the reputation of tax collectors was really not very very high among the Jewish people, because they were considered to be people that are betraying their own people, because the taxes were going to the Roman Empire, and so they were regarded as defrauding the people of Israel, and meanwhile they were becoming very very rich. But what I want to call your attention to is to the background of this story. Tax collectors, they were so unpopular, not only because they collected the taxes in order to send them to the empire, but they did much more than that. They were quite aggressive in the way in which, obviously, they worked for a percentage, and they were very aggressive in the way in which they did that. And it was not unusual that if they suspected that someone was withholding some of the taxes, they would invade the house of the people and examine and just have an inventory of what was there, and so arbitrarily they could decide that this person was evading taxes, and they would take taxes, they would take amounts of whatever goods that they have in their houses on account of those taxes. And the more they were able to collect, the higher was the percentage, the commission that they would get for the collection of these taxes. So this is the background of what is taking place. Now what you are going to see is the real inversion. So what the tax collector did is to invade the house of the poor people there in order to collect taxes to make the empire even richer and the tax collector also much more richer. So this invasion of the house, this invasion of the space of the other, is really the opposite of what we have been talking about, being a guest in the place, in the other's place, in the place of the other. When Jesus now approaches, and this is part of the language, pardon me?
Of course.
Yeah.
So was Zacchaeus trying to see who he was so he could identify him as a non-taxpayer so that he could then go take money from Jesus, or because Zacchaeus said, this is a holy man and I want to see him?
I think he was the latter.
The
latter, yeah. I think he was really
good. Either intention could get him up the tree.
Pardon me?
Either intention could
get him up. Yeah, either intention could get him up the tree. But I think he really was curious. Mm-hmm. I think it was pure curiosity. Now comes this famous preacher that is stirring emotions around the country and is passing by here. So let me take a peek at him and see how he looks like. So I think it was basically out of curiosity that he does that, and Jesus spots him over the tree and names him. This is really interesting. He gives him a name, right? So he recognizes his individuality or whatever he is. But then Jesus says to him, what normally in English and most of the of our languages, the ones that I'm familiar with, it sounds like. Like a self-invitation of Jesus, right? Said, well, I would like to be in your house, so would you invite me, right? And it would be very nice if you would do that. The Greek word for that, today I must stay in your house, that verse 5, right? Make haste and come down, for I must stay at your house today. What is your version that you read?
That's what it is.
That's what it is.
Hurry and come down.
I must stay.
Or I must stay.
Uh-huh. Yeah. The word there is an imperative that is very well known for those who for those who would understand Greek, the word says much more than must. It's much stronger than must. It says, today I will have to enter your house. I will have to enter your house. So it was not a sort of an invitation. Obviously, Zacchaeus could resist it and could avoid it and said, no, my house is close to you. As his house was close to the people or to the poor, as opposed to the house of the poor that Zacchaeus would enter. Yes.
But is that phraseology essentially the same imperative that I, as tax collector, must enter your house and do an inventory?
Yes, exactly. I think Jesus reversed the picture and says, I want to do with you and see how you feel about what you're doing. Do you agree with that? And I think what happens there is in the moment of conversion is the moment in which Zacchaeus says, okay, I will open the house. Mm-hmm. And that's the moment in which Jesus says, today salvation has come to this house. Today salvation has come to this house, right? Not that one day he's going to be in heaven.
How would it be within that culture to Zacchaeus to have this man who he would like to just be able to see, hear his name called out? Because that implies a knowing. And would that be the real connection that starts the conversion?
Yeah, I think that's the case. But the initiative is really Jesus. Mm-hmm. Zacchaeus is only curious about who Jesus is. But it's not an initiative. Just would you invite me? No, I will have to enter your house, mm-hmm. as you have done with others. Now I will have to do it with you. Mm-hmm. So that was the challenge. So this imperative that I will have to do that, and I want to see how you feel about it. And that is the moment in which Jesus is not there to pick up to make an inventory, pick up whatever it is. It's Zacchaeus himself who said, well, I am going to give half to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone, I will give fourfold. The Talmud had the prescription that if you defraud someone in a deal, you have to compensate the person the double. And just to stress the way in which Zacchaeus wants to overreach it, he says, I will give fourfold, whatever it's. And that's the moment in which Jesus says, well, that today salvation has come into this house. Today, this is a church. Mm-hmm. That's what Jesus was saying.
But it's very interesting. We don't know, other than saying, I've got to stay at your house, what Jesus said that changed Zacchaeus' mind. There must have been more. Simply saying, I've got to come to your house today, doesn't seem to me to give Zacchaeus the impetus to be transformed. So what else happened? We don't know.
But yes. But isn't it interesting that we don't know anything? And nothing else is registered. Only this is registered. And when Zacchaeus heard this word, this imperative day, he knew that that was an aggressive gesture on the part of Jesus. And he would have to respond to that in kind, and he would have to say, I close my house. It's going to be simply closed, and it's going to be no metabolic relationship is going to be allowed here. Or then I will allow myself to be vulnerable. And this is one of the things that is part of what I don't want to move ahead. Don't you think that this is in itself, or the background of what Zacchaeus knew that he was doing with the people, in itself a message, quite a powerful message?
Probably.
This man now, he wants to do with me what I had been doing with all the people all the time. Right? And so in the moment in which he says, I allow myself to be vulnerable, that's when salvation comes. Then that's when the church takes place, or the church as an event. And not as a thing, not as a... That was the event in which church happened. Church happens. And that's the moment in which church happened in the story of Zacchaeus. And, yes?
But I think there's significance in the fact that he was curious. He had heard all of these stories. And it's like he was going to check it out. And if you've ever been in the presence of somebody who you would consider a great and holy person, it's like they don't need a neon sign over them saying great and holy person. They speak and with authority. So that he just, I think, connected the dots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was up to him to respond to Zacchaeus. Mm-hmm. And it was not responding, well, what about if you serve me?
Next Tuesday.
Yeah, what about next Tuesday? Yeah. It's now, right, exactly. Yeah. It's now. And it's now that church happens. It's now that salvation has come to this house. So I think this is one of the ways in which church is taking place when the relationship in this metabolism that I'm talking about, this exchange that takes place, when it is asymmetric, when it is symmetric, what you're going to see happening is the church taking place just by this encounter of different realities, like the example that I gave of the peasant league and the church, right? So there was a sort of a symmetry between the two. There was not one overpowering the other, but there was an encounter in which church could take place exactly by this mixture of languages that comes from the political realm and then comes from the biblical stories. This is the fundamental frame of reference in which church happens, in this metabolic relationship, in this exchange between the biblical story and the everyday life of the people in their struggle in order to get their rights and whatever they are struggling for. So when this happens, there is church happens, right? But then there are encounters that are very asymmetric, and I'm using the example of Zacchaeus as one of the example of this asymmetry, in which church happens due to vulnerability. Due to vulnerability. And vulnerability on the part of whom? And this is very important. Kids. On the part of the powerful, right? Right. It is Zacchaeus' house that is. So in this case, it's not Zacchaeus that's being invited to the houses that he had invaded before and say, well, let's have a nice meal here and everything is going to be okay and fine. No. Zacchaeus' house has to be, so to say, plundered before church can happen. Yes, Arch.
And if that's the case, then by corollary, Jesus is a dramatically higher power than Zacchaeus, the tax collectors in the Roman Empire, because he's making them vulnerable.
Well, let me just finish this. I think it can. Yes, I would agree with you. But this is not only Jesus. I think all the powerless can embody this kind of an attitude. Mm-hmm. And let me give you an example that comes from my experience in working with landless peasants in Brazil. There are about 12 million of them. So this is quite a huge population. In Brazilian society, there are displaced people that they work sometimes as seasonal workers in farmers, and they are extremely poor, and they have lost their land due to the change in agrarian policy that happened in the 60s and 70s in Brazil, in which monoculture was implemented for export, and so soybeans that people keep complaining and. Here in the United States about, because we are messing the U.S. market with the production of soybeans in Brazil, and also wheat and other grains that are produced there and heavily produced there. So that the small farmer was really, their life was made impossible. Their way of gathering the resources to survive was made impossible. They were no longer given any bank loans, and everything was given to this big mono farms that would produce all this grain for export. This was a very radical change in the agrarian policy of the Brazilian government, end of the 60s and beginning of the of the 70s. So in this context, all this amazing population of landless peasants that once were, or at least their parents, were owners of small farmers, they were dislodged, uprooted, and ended up in utter poverty and would find work when the harvest would come in some places. So they start to organize themselves and in a movement that was their movement, which is probably the most political and significant force in Brazilian politics until today. And the church has been accompanying this through the work of the organization I have been working with that had three basic purposes. One was to accompany them, just to be with them. The second is to provide for education and training, and just to allow them to understand what their situation was and what their reality was. And the third one was to provide for spiritual support for them. So these were the three things that were being done with this movement, which was not very easy, and it was not very innocent either. So the law had to be broken all the time. Like, for example, they would invade farms that were unproductive and occupy them. And sometimes many people died in the attempt of the government of expelling them from those farms. Sometimes they were very successful because of political pressure, and they ended up receiving that farm and collectively as a cooperative develop it. But this is another example of almost the reverse image of vulnerability. Is the church also happens in the moment in which people do that act of affirming and searching for their dignity and saying, all this land here is idle, no one is using them, we are going to use them. And it does not matter if someone has the title of property over it, it needs to be productive and needs to feed the people of the land. And so this was some of the things that they would do. And the organization for which I worked was not a political organization or the political arm that would do the invasion, but we would follow them into those situations because they were the most fragile in that in those circumstances. And there was one, and that's when House of Church happened. I remember one occasion. I was not there on that, but a friend of mine and two friends of mine, a pastor, a Lutheran pastor, and a Roman Catholic priest, they were accompanying one of those groups that did this invasion of one of the farms. And both of them, the priest and the pastor, they were there. There are so many things to take care of, starting with having water that is clean. And we are talking about sometimes 600 families. In that case, it was 600 families, sometimes 200 families, sometimes 1,000 or 1,200 families that just go together normally in the U hours of the morning, like 3 o'clock in the morning, and normally in the weekend. For some reason, there is a law that you cannot dislodge anyone from the place that they are occupying during a weekend. I don't know why. So they would normally do it on Saturday mornings at 3 o'clock in the morning. And so they would get some time. So there are so many details to be taken care of for that's such a huge population. So they have to put the tents, which is black plastic that they would be living in for quite a while until negotiations were going on whether they could stay or not. And in one of those occasions, in which these two friends of mine that worked with the organization with me, they were there and they were hectic like hell, trying to help in every detail and putting up the tents and finding the sources for fresh water, potable water, and so on and so forth. Suddenly, one of the leaders of the landless peasants came to them and said, "Hey, listen to this passage. Hey, listen, you know that we can do that ourselves. You don't need to worry. What we really need is someone to lead us in celebration for how far has God brought us up to this point." And this was an eye opener for him. And he recognized that he was so active and doing all those things that that any one of the peasants would be able to do better than he could do it. And he was failing to do whatever he really could do, and the reason why he was there, to be also in spiritual support and lead them in worship on that occasion. So that's what they were expecting from him. And this is sort of the reverse scenario from the one that I presented in the case of Zacchaeus, in which there is when the asymmetry falls on the side of the weak one, and they take charge of encountering the other in this asymmetric relationship, then what we have is church happens by intervention, by invasion, even if you will, by invasion, by occupying another space in this asymmetric relationship. So what you have then is a scenario of three possibilities in which church is taking place in these social encounters. One is a symmetrical reality in which there is this exchange at the same level. The base Christian community would be an example. The second one is on the part when it happens on the side of the powerful, it happens when there is vulnerability there. When it happens on the side of the powerless, it is when they are empowered and they take over the defense of their destiny. So these are the different ways in which one can imagine church to be happening, or the church to take place. Final remark on this issue. I haven't, and probably you are already impatient with the fact that I have been offering you a sort of a phenomenological description of the way in which church emerges or church happens, church as event, without saying anything about church structure and church polity, right? And I think this is an important topic. We don't start tabula rasa. We have already churches in which we are worshiping, in which we are serving, and what we do with them when they have their own history and when they have their own structure, when they are already there in order to survive and to be able to perform whatever they need to perform. A philosopher called Immanuel Kant in the end of the 18th century, in which he proposed the following syllogism, almost in a cynical way. He says, "Well, when one creates an institution, one creates this institution in order to solve a problem, right? Any institution is created in order to address an issue, to address a problem." Then he says, "And what's the first thing that this institution is going to make? Make sure that the problem is not solved, right? Because otherwise it doesn't need to exist, right?
In the case of Holden, the world's taking care of that for us."
Yeah, exactly. And so, insofar as the structure is concerned, cynically or not, we need to be aware of the fact that this is the inertia that carries institutions on and on. Is because we don't know how to say the problem is solved, so let's move on, right? And just abandon that which has served its purpose for a while, but doesn't need to be anymore. But we cling to it. We just don't want to lose it, right? And this is the idolatrous character that every institution always has, and it's always the risk that its transitory character, the fact that it's being a means, only a means, always get confused with it being an end in itself. And that's the reason why I was trying to avoid, because if we start to discuss the church from the standpoint of what it is structurally, we get caught in this attempt of justifying the means for an end, its transitory character, as something that would be definitely there, something that is already the kingdom of God in Nuce, that means in its beginning, and so forth. So I think it is this is an important comment that I would like to reference that I would like to make. But without denying the fact that anything that we do does require a little bit of structure, at least, right? There is no possibility in which we are going to be able to organize anything that would be not simply any spontaneous emergence that simply disappears in the moment in which it emerges without having any structure. But to keep this structure on its very place, I think it's what is the difficult task to perform. You know the story of Mary and Martha, right? Jesus visiting their house, right? Mm-hmm. And Jesus comes to their house, and Martha is there taking care of all the chores of the house and cleaning and cooking and so on and so forth, running back and forth. And Mary couldn't care less, right? She's just there with Jesus, right? And then Martha comes to Jesus and says, Lord, come on. Don't you see that I am really here doing all this work? And Mary is just sitting here with you and enjoying having the time of her life. And I am killing myself in preparing everything. And what was Jesus' response? She has chosen the best part. The best part. Okay, but the interesting thing in that is that Jesus doesn't say, you have chosen the wrong part. She has just chosen the best part. But in fact, someone needs to do that. Someone needs to create the structure. Someone needs to create the environment in which Mary can be there sitting at the feet of Jesus, right? So I think this is Jesus' approach to the way in which function and institution are related to each other, right? So that the function of an institution is always to provide for the best environment in which that the most important thing, the best part, can take place, and the best part is Mary there with Jesus. But Mary would not be there with Jesus in any place, in any space. The better, the more structured, and the better provided for a space is the one that allows itself to be a conduit for this true devotion to take place, for the best part to be really effective, right? But you never confuse it. It's not the end in itself. So Martha's text, Martha's task, is really the task of church bureaucrats, right, and theologians as well. So to provide for the structure in which people can really feel that they are allowed to sit and to just be in a space that is providing them for a sufficient room for them to exercise their own piety. Any questions or comments that you have? Yes.
This might be stepping back a little bit in the mm-hmm. discussion, but how do you, from your experience in Brazil or from the text in Zacchaeus, how does one make an intervention towards someone powerful and give them that feeling of vulnerability rather than defensiveness? What was it about Zacchaeus in that situation that made him willing to be vulnerable rather than saying, I don't know what you're talking about, being more on the defensive side? Does that sort of make sense? How does that... I mean, obviously there has to be some sort of curiosity that Zacchaeus had. How do you, in a situation where those peasants are going to the farm, how... Do you just go on faith that the person in power is not going to be defensive? And
yeah. You remember that there are two stories, and I don't remember which one is which, One is the lawyer, the other is this young man that comes to Jesus with the same question, right? What should I do in order to be saved? And Jesus asked him, you know the commandments, and the lad is pretty smart, and he knows all the commandments, right? And Jesus says to him, well, sell everything that you have and give it to the poor, right? And the story says that when he walked out or away, they said. So I think this is the answer to your question. I think it's really getting a camel through a needle's eye. The likelihood that someone like Zacchaeus is going to show wrong. So I think this is an exemplary story that might happen, and I think it happens. For example, you can have it's not always pure, but I think there are some examples of this happening. In very critical situations, I think and way of talking about the parable of the camel and the needle's eye in modern movie making would be Schindler's List, right? So that would be one example that someone is using their power or whatever and risking something. And the point is precisely that you have to risk something. You have to be at a point in which you cannot calculate anymore what is going to be the outcome. And I think this is rather important. The logic of the kingdom is the logic that stops the commerce, that stops the negotiation, that stops the economy as it normally happens. And you need to stop strategizing. And Michel de Certeau is a Roman Catholic Jesuit philosopher, and he says that in the logic of the kingdom of God, what you have is no longer a strategy but only tactics. Right. You make some moves, not because you just make some moves because they are necessary under the circumstance to be made, but not because you are calculating what's going to be the end result of what's coming out of that. So if that happens, then it happens. But your question is precisely the question that people have always ask: Can they really divest themselves in this way? And Jesus says, "Well, it's very unlikely, but can happen, right? For God, everything is possible." And this is, I think, also, it's not only the question of whether you have possession or not, but whether you recognize, and I think whether you recognize who Christ is or not. And I think this is the point of Zacchaeus' story, that he is curious, right? That he is curious. So there is an eagerness to know the face of Jesus and recognize even the challenge that Jesus brings to him. It was quite a gesture for him to open his house, knowing that he needed to protect his house. His house was the one that was not going to be invaded. And I think this eagerness to know the face of Jesus and recognize the face of Jesus is what distinguishes Zacchaeus from that rich man, that young man that comes to Jesus. And I think this is the basic story of Matthew 25 of the Great Judgment, that some people are going to be said, well, when I was thirsty, when I was in prison, when I was hungry, and when and so on and so forth, you provided.